Livewire with Jason Moyle.
Hello, I'm Jason and welcome to Livewire. My guest on the show today is Sean Dixon and Ross Sinclair from the hit recording band The Soup Dragons. Hello, Sean and Ross. How are you today?
Hi, Jason.
Great to be here.
Oh, brilliant, brilliant. So, obviously, the Soup Dragons have reformed, but you started back in 1985, I believe, Sean?
We did, yes. We started in 1985 when we were all children.
Okay, because you were performing in other bands before the Soup Dragons, and then they kind of formed from there, didn't they?
I wouldn't call them bands. I would call them kind of friends getting together. Well, yeah, I suppose they were bands, but we kind of used to have like bedroom bands, you know, bands that formed in your bedroom that might have got the odd gig. But I think the Soup Dragons were, the Soup Dragons were the first kind of proper band I was in, I suppose.
I think everybody was in other kind of bands, and it used to be the typical of a sort of small scene somewhere like Glasgow. Everybody's playing in different bands and doing different things, but somehow when we all got together as the Soup Dragons, it just sort of clicked, and that was the one that kind of took off, really.
And you had your first demo tape soon after that, didn't you, when you were playing local gigs as the Soup Dragons?
Yeah, I mean, the first demo tape, we released a flexi disc called Few Are the Only Girl in the World, Would You Take Me? That's what it was called. And that flexi disc got Single of the Week in the NME. And it cost, the whole thing cost £35 to make.
Oh, brilliant.
It cost £35.
It was a lot then, back then, wasn't it? I just thought of that.
Yeah, I think it was about another £40 to get the 500 flexi discs made. But yeah, it was Single of the Week in NME, and
the only way to get it was to buy Shashil's fanzine, which called Shashil's Popcorn, which I think cost 50p with the free Soup Dragons flexi disc on it.
And that was, I think, the first ever fanzine, first ever flexi disc to get Single of the Week. That might be the only flexi disc.
Possibly the last one as well, yeah. Yeah.
But it kind of exploded from that. It was, John Peel phoned my house, and we did the John Peel session, and then we did an NME interview, which was likely the biggest NME interview we ever had to date. It was over 4 pages.
And in fact, it was amazing. We were so skint that, I mean, John Peel actually sent you some money to get us down there, Sean, didn't he?
I had to go and meet John Peel in Glasgow, and he pulled out £150 out of his pocket. And he said, "Here's £150." Because when BBC phoned, it was John Peel's producer, and I said on the phone, "Listen, we don't have any money to get to London." And she said, "Let me speak to John, and I'll call you back." And she called back, and she said, "John said, can you meet him in Glasgow in 2 weeks' time because he's going to be there?" And I went to Glasgow Queen Margaret University, and yeah, he gave me £150, which I promised him I would give him back one day. And the last time I ever saw John Peel was in Bell Cell when he was up. We were doing this documentary, and I was in his car, and I tried to hide £150 down the side of his passenger seat, and he turned around to me and I went, "I can see what you're doing, Mr. Dixon, and you will not be doing that." So I never got the chance to actually give him the £150 back.
That was amazing to have supporters like that, and Janice Long as well, who we did sessions with, and you know, and in fact that was part of us getting back together. A guy called Nick in London, Precious Records, he put out a bunch of singles that from all the BBC sessions just in the last year, which is really exciting to kind of see all them again and hear them. It's great stuff.
Because you had in 1986 a independent number two hit record, because it was an independent chart, Whole Wide World. So that must have broken through, and that was when you probably met John Peel.
That was kind of the first, I suppose, proper single that wasn't a flexi disc. That was like the proper hard single. That went straight in the top of the indie charts. And as you remember back then, there used to be a thing called the Chart Show.
Yeah,
on television, and they were a huge supporter of the Soup Dragons. They always showed their videos, and they showed Whole Wide World. And once again, that video cost £50 to make. It was recorded. It wasn't, It was one take. It was one take. Yeah, there was
we went into this little video. We went into a little video studio in Edinburgh and just kind of like something you could go and just, I don't know, film your family get together or something. And we just like ran through the song and then had this actual, a kind of crazy surreal video that one of our fans had sent us. And we kind of mixed the two together. And it was this kind of mad, kind of surreal, kind of sort of take on the video, but it was great. Cost nothing, just great. Shown on the chart show.
So you obviously had success with being on the chart show and also had minor hits in the 80s, but it wasn't until 1990 where you had your famous worldwide hit, I'm Free, as well. So tell us how that came about.
How did the infamous I'm Free come about? It was myself at like 4 o'clock in the morning coming back from some dodgy club or something, and I turned on BBC Two, and lo and behold, the thing that came on TV was the Stones at Hyde Park, which I'm Free came on. I think it's the only time they actually did it live on, it was filmed, and they did I'm Free, and I think this actually was the only time they did it on stage, someone told me, up until 1990 when they started playing it again off the back of Us. But I kind of like saw that, stuck in my head, I'm Free, you don't want it any old time. At that point of time, Thatcher was basically trying to close down Clubland and close down all the raving that was going on in the UK at the time. So there was this kind of like the kids trying to fight against the power, so to speak. And I just kind of come up with this idea. We were in the studio a few weeks later to do a version of I'm Free, but it was before the internet. I didn't have a copy of it. I didn't have the copy of the record. To this day, I've still never owned a copy of the Stones' I'm Free. I actually don't actually know it that well, so I just kind of wrote down some words and things.
Yeah, I've only ever heard the one from the Stones in the Park as well, which is a really rough kind of open version sort of thing, really kind of basic sort of.
So in the Don't Be Afraid of Your Freedom was kind of an idea I had to kind of turn the song on its head to make it question freedom, as opposed to like, because the Stones version was all very kind of summer of love, hippy dippy, you know, I'm free, do I want to go on all the time wearing a big white flowing cloak and, you know, being that free. Whereas I suppose I was kind of questioning freedom. Don't be afraid of your freedom. And, you know, are you free to get your blues, which isn't in the Stones version? There's lots of things. And then the infamous thing of like, oh God, let's put a gospel choir on it. So I picked up Yellow Pages and phoned up the local gospel church, who said, can you fax the lyrics through? So I wrote all these lyrics and I did God in every second line. I was like, I'm free to love God any old time. God is, you know, I just made it really religious. And they all came round the next day. We had 40 people in the studio. And they all sang I'm Free over the space of a few hours and then left. It's funny because one of them, you know, because we were Scottish, started singing Amazing Grace. And there's a really strange bit on the 12-inch of I'm Free. We can slightly hear it, but they're doing ad-libs. And also, because somebody goes, oh, and then and the 12-inch also somebody, because the poll tax riots were going on.
Yeah.
And I was telling them the story about the Don't Be Afraid of Your Freedom and like fighting against the raves closing down. So somebody started doing kind of gospel ad-libs about no more poll tax, and you can hear that in the 12-inch version. It was really weird. We didn't, to be honest, and then spent 2 days mixing it with a guy called Mark Maguire, who made Theme from S Express, because I loved the sound of S Express's Theme from S Express. So I said to our manager, can I use that engineer? And this guy came. And we spent 48 hours no sleep mixing that record, because it was a mess. It was on so many tracks and it wasn't even arranged. It was all over the place. So we had to spend ages arranging it. Never really thought much of it, because by 3 or 4 days in, you know, I was a kind of bit, you know, not bored with it, but I just thought you heard it so much. And then we played it to somebody in the record. Somebody in the record company came round and played it, and she burst out crying like within 5 minutes. She was sitting there with tears rolling down her face. And I'm like, are you okay? And she's like, that's one of the most amazing things I've ever heard. And that was the point. It was like, oh, you know, oh, this is actually, it's just a dog's dinner, or is it really good? And it came out. And it kind of, as what they call these days, you know, it was something that, it was a reactionary record, because it reacted to people in many different ways, you know, because being free is quite an open, you know, it's quite an open meaning to, you know, lots of people have different kinds of freedom and lots of people have different, you know, ideas of what freedom is. So it seemed to kind of cover everybody, you know, people that wanted to be free to rave, people that wanted to be, you know, there's, you know, it became people's divorce song for a while, okay. Which was a bit, because I kept getting messages from people saying that there's this woman told me that this is a true story. She came home one day, she had enough of her husband, and she bought the CD of I'm Free, and she put it on her CD player. And as you know, you used to be able to loop a CD on a CD player. She had the single version of I'm Free on a loop, and her husband came home from work with this blasting in the house, and she'd left him. She never went back.
I didn't hear that before. That's a classic. That's great.
Right, so it's a breakup song then as well.
Yeah, it's kind of like the amount of angles that I'm Free covers is crazy, you know, and the amount of adverts and campaigns it's been in regarding freedom is like freedom bank cards, you know, freedom perfume, free this, free that. I mean, it's, you don't realise that such a simple terminology can be such a powerful statement. And I suppose it kind of taught me as well how to write lyrics in a way, because it was a bit like, I would have never wrote a song, you know, as simple as that. I'm free to do it one any old time. But when you think about it, that simplicity of it is like a nursery rhyme that makes people connect to.
And of course, that was that song, I'm Free, was the follow-up to Mother Universe, which was actually a top 30 hit for you previously as well.
It was really weird because it came out at the start of summer, and it spent, which would never happen these days, it spent 18 weeks in the top 40. It just kept going up and up and up and up and up. And eventually it got to the highest point, which was number 5.
Yeah.
We were told if you'd have sold the amount of records that you've sold in the last 8 weeks, you'd have went straight in at number 1. But it wasn't. It was getting slowly discovered by people. And then the weird thing was, it started to go down the charts, and then it went back up and it would go down. So it was kind of like moving about. It was going up and down the charts. And it was really weird because we were always next to Delight, Groovers in the Heart. So it kind of felt like that summer, Groovers in the Heart, 9-3 were like brother and sister records going up and down the charts.
And
we ended up playing gigs with Delight. You know, we ended up going on tour with them. And would you believe in circus tents in Germany?
Oh,
which was completely like...
a bit different.
It was amazing. But looking back at it now, I don't think I took it. I think I maybe never took it for granted, but I think everything was happening so quick. Thinking back to it now, it was literally one of the best experiences ever, spending a week with Bootsy Collins and his band, because basically it was Delight and the backing band was Funkadelic. So it was like, you turn up the first night and it was like, I just saw Bootsy Collins. I just saw, you know, these people are in Funkadelic. And then all the flight cases would come in and it'd be... it'd be Funkadelic, Bootsy Collins.
Well, let's move forward to the reforming of the Sea of Dragons. So how did that come about?
Well, over the last couple of years, a few different sort of labels had approached us to see if we wanted to kind of put out some albums of kind of old stuff and bits and pieces. So we, sort of from the discussion about that, we eventually kind of... we went kind of local with a Glasgow label called Last Night from Glasgow, and we put out this sort of vinyl compilation of something that in a way maybe almost could have been our first album, that, you know, it took us a while to get the first album out. So this in a way kind of, there was a couple of compilation albums that came out in the States and in France that were sort of like the first few singles and some other stuff. So in a way, there was a bit of a hole there, you know, in the kind of releases. So we kind of put this together. It was a bit of a labor of love, kind of, and there's some stuff from sessions and different bits and pieces on it and the first three singles. And from that, that created a bit of a buzz and folk were interested in that. And then some promoters kind of started talking to us. And then there was these appeal session releases that Nick at Precious did. And, you know, there was just sort of a bit of a kind of momentum growing. And, you know, eventually we kind of started talking to each other about it. And I think at first we all thought the other one wouldn't want to do it sort of thing. And we were kind of chatting about it. But eventually after a bit of discussion, we all thought, well, what the hell, you know, it's been good fun getting together, talking about doing this new release and, you know, doing the cover and doing all the bits and pieces. And so we just kind of like, I think, talked ourselves into it really. And And then, you know, we kind of did a couple of new songs as well, which are the new single, which is just kind of out. And that's been really brilliant because that meant getting back in the studio together and recording again. And that was really exciting. And that's made it really fresh, actually, to feel that, you know, it's not just looking back, but it's a bit of looking forward. And that's been particularly kind of good, and just to be back in the room again, and now rehearsing as well, of course, and that's great.
And of course, you were part of a documentary as well, weren't you? Teenage Superstars.
Yeah, Teenage Superstars. I think I had quite a big turning point as well, because it was nice to see the family of bands that you were with all. Talking about their experiences with how things happened to them. And it was just really nice to be part of this lovely Glasgow scene that we're quite proud of being part of. And a lot of our friends and other bands talking about, you know, there's a lot of love for each other. We all kind of looked out for each other in those days as well. So, but that's a really lovely thing to be, you know, the tour that we're about to do, we have, you know, we have the Vaselines and we have the BMX Bandits and we have the Pastels DJing. So it's nice to have those friends around us still.
Yeah. So tell us about your, because the double A side and effectively your new single, it's Love Is Love, is the one we're featuring today. So tell us a bit about that one.
Well, that was a kind of discussion we had about doing some new songs. And I think somebody said about write something like you were 18. And that's when I took my dogs for a walk and realised, how did I used to write songs? I was like walking the dogs thinking, I didn't write songs when I was 18. And then for some reason, the chorus, Love Is Love, no matter who the other, no matter what colour, came in my head. And I kind of thought to myself, I wonder what it would be right to write a kind of biography, you know, like write a kind of an idea of me as an 18-year-old writing about me as a grown-up man and what he would think of him. And that's basically what the Love Is Love song is. And I sang it in my phone while I was walking the dogs. And I came home and got a keyboard out.
It was great. You just sent us like a WhatsApp kind of message with this sort of really simple kind of like demo on it. And it was so much just like the old days. And, you know, when you used to bring them all into the rehearsal rooms. And it was just great. You know, it's just like, kind of like that, and just but with all the experience of, you know, that you've got now, it's just it's fantastic.
I used to write a lot, so my dad used to have a dictaphone because something to do with my dad's work, because my dad worked with insecurity firms and things, and he had a dictaphone. So I've always had a dictaphone since I was a young kid, and I think that's how I used to write a lot of the Super Dragon stuff, wasn't it? Into the dictaphone and bring it to rehearsals. So it was the same kind of thing. I sang it until, you know, I had my phone while I was with the dog, and I sang it into the memo. And the memo app and my phone, and got back and, you know, put it on the piano and sent it to the guys. And they went into, I think you went to Shashil's house. And,
yeah, we just kind of worked it up. And it was great then. You came up and we kind of went into this wee studio in Glasgow. And yeah, it's been a couple of days recorded the tracks. It's great.
And that was the first time the four of us had been in a room together for like hundreds of years. And like, you know, like 1, 2, 3, 4, Ross clicks the drumsticks, 1, 2, 3, 4 and play. And we played, and at the end of it, there was, you know, it was a kind of lump in the throat experience that we actually still sounded the same. So it kind of, it was quite obvious that, you know, the sound of the Soup Dragons are the four people that make that sound, because to sound like that, the four of us have to be there. And that was a lovely moment, realizing it's, you know, it's, We all contain a quarter of the way this thing is. And
it's amazing just the muscle memory of it, although it's been such a long time, you know, as soon as you sort of count the songs off, and it's just like the energy's there, the dynamic, the sort of passion for it, you know. So that's what we're really excited about, getting out on the road and kind of really excited to play the songs to people. And because they're sounding brilliant in rehearsal and so dynamic and energetic, and no, it's going to be amazing just stepping out on stage to play them again.
Okay, we'll talk about the other A side as well, because it's No Music on a Dead Planet, which features Fred Snyder from B52s.
Yeah, Fred, we asked Fred to jump in on this one. I've known Fred for a while, and even back in the 90s, the Strip Dragons and the B-52s were supposed to tour together, which never happened because of the usual politics. They were on a different record company to us, so the record company we were on wouldn't give us money to go on the tour, and because it was a tour of America. So we ended up, we went with InXS because they were on the same label as us. But I always kind of, you know, regretted that never happened, touring with the B-52s, because it would have been an amazing tour. But we kind of stayed friends through social media, and I worked with Fred about 5 years ago making a record. And when we were doing No Music on A Dead Planet, it was just in the studio. It kind of sounded a bit B-52s. There's something about that, the vibe of the song. And I suppose because it's got the word planet, you know, they used a lot of planets. the conversation, like it was the Shield, said, why don't you ask Fred? So I actually texted him when we was in the studio. I was like, Fred, do you want to sing another track? He went, okay.
But it was kind of funny. It's sort of 21st century Soup Drinks. We kind of wrote that one by WhatsApp, by kind of everyone bouncing about things back and forward. So it seemed kind of fitting in a way to get to Fred to kind of literally phone his part in the best kind of way, you know, doing the kind of...
He was doing a run of B-52 shows in Las Vegas, because I'm kind of like doing the last few shows, and he was doing the B-52 shows, and he sent us the vocal when he was just about to do the sound check. So
that's great, straight from the dressing room. But it's great on that one as well. We kind of partnered, you know, with these guys, Music Declares Emergency, and you know, they sort of premiered the video, and you know, we've got information on the back of the sleeve about that, and actually all our kids sing on that track as well, all backing vocals, so it was great to get them in the studio. And you know, we've been away for a long time, and a lot has changed since we've been away, so it seemed really fitting to be kind of working with Music Declares Emergency. And I've kind of designed a new t-shirt that you can buy from them, and you know, so that was kind of good to do that. So it's just the whole package of the single just feels really exciting, you know.
Well, it's great talking to you, Sean, and Ross as well. And good luck with your new music. Good luck with the tour. Would you like to introduce your brand new single, Love is Love?
We are the Soup Dragons. We are back in business. And this is called Love.
Love is Love.
Love. Thank you very much, Jason.
See you guys.
Take care.
Livewire is produced by Steve Osborne Media. Steve Osborne Media.